This is Jacobin Radio. I'm Susie Wiseman. On today's show, we talked to Professor Warren Montag, a longtime scholar and activist who has been targeted for speaking out against Israel's war on Gaza. In November, he gave a talk at his university arguing that anti-Zionism is not anti-Semitism. What followed was an ADL campaign, the Anti-Defamation League, to get him fired as retaliation. Warren joins us with his personal testimony, his take on the campaign to silence critics of Israeli policy, what it means for freedom of expression, and so much more when our program returns in just a moment. This is Jacobin Radio. I'm Susie Wiseman. Very pleased to have Warren Montag back with us. He's a tenured full professor at Occidental College and was just targeted recently for a talk at a college forum on the issues raised in the U.S. by Israel's war on Gaza. His topic was one he had spoken on numerous times since the first intifada, and that was that anti-Zionism is not anti-Semitism. We're going to get his understanding of that, as well as the story of what happened subsequently. And we're also going to ask Warren what this campaign of intimidation and retaliation means for freedom of expression, freedom of inquiry, and so much more, especially in an atmosphere where book banning and stifling of critical thought, harassment of librarians, teachers, and professors is broad, rampant, and dangerous. So, Warren, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Let me introduce you properly. I said that you were a tenured professor. You're a full professor of English and comparative literature at Occidental College here in Los Angeles, and the author of several books on the work of Althusser, Spinoza, Adam Smith, including the other Adam Smith, Althusser and his contemporaries, Body, Masses, Power, Spinoza and his contemporaries, and The Unthinkable Swift. And if you just Google Warren Montag without the UE at the end of Montag, you can find so much more. So we're going to spend a lot of time on this issue today because it's both international and domestic and ominous. And so if you could just begin by telling the listeners what happened on your campus. Mm-hmm. You mentioned, I should just say, that you published a piece on this, of what happened at the Verso blog. And there you said that you've done this talk on anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism on many occasions over many years. So what was different this time in both the reaction and response to your views expressed at the forum mm-hmm. and then afterwards?
Yeah, let me start by saying that I was somewhat reluctant even to write something about it or talk on even on the show, because I thought that what happened to me was not as spectacular or as destructive for me as what I think other people have experienced. And the reason that I wanted to talk about it finally was that in various ways that may be subtle or not so visible, you know, for me, I wasn't risking very much because I couldn't get fired, really. But there are many different ways of pressuring people and intimidating people and threatening them directly or indirectly. And the experience of seeing my colleagues at school even reacting to my experience, which they found more disturbing than I found it, really. I could see that it would be quite easy to intimidate people, make them feel uncomfortable, and not because the people aren't courageous, or it's quite the opposite. I mean, many of the people who were involved in this fair, in terms of faculty, were untenured, and it was extremely courageous of them to do this in the face of massive threats and opposition and, you know, a lot of intimidation. So To go back to your question, what caught me off guard, because I, you know, usually I'm fairly in tune with the kinds of things that are going on around politics and that sort of thing. but it was nothing like what I'd experienced ever at the college or in politics and on campuses. The last time I gave the talk was 2018, and it was around the time of the March of the Great Return, which was connected with what I was talking about. And I spent a lot of time talking about anti-Zionist movements among Jews prior to World War II, and how socialist and communist groups, especially the Bund, in which Jews played a very important role. The Bund was an exclusively Jewish, Yiddish-speaking organization in Eastern Europe that advocated for nationalism, but not based on a territory. And also not exclusionary in any way. That one of the interesting things about the Bund is they actually, in Russia before the revolution, they tried to initiate a kind of umbrella organization, and they sent emissaries to the Muslim Central Republics, were part of Russia at the time, and tried to make contacts with them, and it was fairly successful. So it's an interesting history. Okay.
I specifically want to ask you more about the history, but let's first just get for the listeners,
Yeah, sorry about that.
no, it's okay. What happened?
Okay, yes. Yeah, so I came to this particular meeting the last November, about a month after October 7th. And there had been discussion before. I was part of a group that placed an article in the student newspaper condemning the war in Gaza and saying that it was an example of a settler colonial society trying to carry out ethnic cleansing, and it was looking like there was a kind of genocidal intent, and I can talk about that. And so we put that letter into the newspaper finally, and the response was surprisingly negative. I mean, there's plenty of sympathy on the part of students and many faculty, not all, for Palestine, but the level of pushback from Zionist organizations that was very surprising to me. It was very, I mean, there was a level of rage directed at any of us who could say that there was something wrong with Israel's reaction. I mean, the sense was simply by the fact that Israel was attacked by Hamas meant that they had unlimited right of revenge in some way. Okay. And this, I mean, people were motivated by something like that, even if they wouldn't articulate it that way. We had quite a bit of discussion in the newspaper, and there were people who, and what was interesting, not students and not even just community members, but parents, which I found very disturbing and strange. And they wrote to us, a few of them wrote to all the people who signed this collective statement, and it, not initially in a rude way, but sort of saying, "You're all wrong. You don't know what you're talking about." And if you can imagine that not being rude, but it could get a lot worse. And okay, this was unpleasant in some ways, but we responded back and forth. And around that time, I was asked to make a presentation that Susie mentioned on what does this war mean in the US? What does it say about the US, et cetera? It was maybe just a few days before the lecture. The title was announced more or less publicly. And it was exactly, as you said, Susie, the anti-Zionism is not the same thing as anti-Semitism, et cetera. And the reaction, even, I mean, both from my colleagues, certain colleagues, somebody accused me of hate speech because apparently Zionist is an ethnic category or something. And I had no right to say that and blah, blah, blah. Other people were upset that I was critical of Israel. And it was a very, very different response than I'd ever gotten. Nobody ever paid attention to it before. They didn't care if I talked about it. And I should have known that this is the harbinger of even worse things to come, but I didn't know what to expect.
It's interesting because I think you're right. It's not just on your campus and elsewhere that it's been surprising in some ways to see that sort of level of intimidation. We see it, in the hearings and getting university, college presidents fired. But also on the other side, and I'll ask this later, it's also been amazing to see the breadth of this movement in solidarity that we've never
Oh,
seen
yeah.
before. Even the most liberal campuses. It used to be the case that you could have these kinds of discussions, but now you're seeing pushback. So one of the things that, and I don't mean to interrupt your story. I want you to continue to tell it, but I wonder how you characterize so far this kind of pushback. You said it to me privately that you wanted to talk about the weaponization of
Yes.
anti-Semitism, which is what this is. And I wondered if you saw it as successful. We did see in the UK, the successful use of that, and it destroyed Jeremy Corbyn's electoral campaign. And it seemed almost absurd on its face in Britain, but in the end, that was so successful. And now we see that same attempt to be used here. The Congress, led by the Republicans, passed a resolution essentially saying anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism. And so there's this broad-based effort to punish critical voices and silence dissent. So, yeah, I guess my larger question is, by telling the rest of your story and what happened, what do you think? Is it successful or is it backfiring?
Well, I think the situation is extremely polarized to some extent along generational lines. There is actually what I think is a very small group of Zionist students completely adopted the position that this is all anti-Semitism. But I think for the most part, there wasn't much support for that on campus. And I think that among Jews, especially, the younger generation is completely opposed to Zionism in Israel. I mean, you see a Jewish Voice for Peace and If Not Now, When? I mean, they are along with the Palestinian youth movement, among the most active parts of this movement. And they're pretty fearless. I mean, they go out and they do occupations and freeway blockage, I mean, everything. And I think that's very unusual compared to the past. And I think that it shows that there's a whole segment, and these are large groups. I mean, Jewish Voice for Peace, I think there's a periphery of like several hundred thousand people that participate in their activities. This is really unprecedented anytime, since the establishment of the State of Israel. That's on the one side. There's a very hopeful signs of resistance, even on the part of Jews and others in these mass demonstrations to Israel's abuse of Palestinians. But I think on the other side, I mean, this is why it's the parents who are active, not the students, which I find absolutely astounding. I've never, ever seen that before. I mean, and before I gave my lecture, I got a number of letters from parents, which were fairly abusive, based only on the title of my lecture, that I would dare to impugn Zionism at all. I don't know if they knew that I was Jewish or not. I don't know. And each letter inevitably had something about, we pay your salary, you better do what we say, or something, which
You're their client, in other words.
something like that. Or I'm their employee,
Your employee,
that
right.
I should.
Yeah.
And I never responded to any letters. I would do
But
that.
how did your administration react to that? Because I agree with you.
Not
In all my
very
years of
well.
teaching, I've never had to deal with parents on the one or two occasions,
I
like
know.
I have had it. The administration said, your duty is to the student and not to the family of the student.
I mean, your administration was a bit more understanding than mine in this case. But I think that their feeling was, why are you doing things that are making the parents angry at us? It's not you who has to field the complaints, but we do. But I think it was probably a fairly small group who repeatedly called them. But I think that instead of saying to the parents, there's free speech here, freedom of academic inquiry, et cetera, they made agreements to try to stop me from speaking and discourage me from speaking, et cetera. And I think in part with some of them, they caved into the pressure. And in other cases, they agreed with the parents. I'm not going to name names or
No.
positions. They thought I was evil or something like that for bringing this up. So, I mean, there's a structural problem because they depend on these people for money, not just tuition, but donations. And, as we've seen with Harvard, Columbia, et cetera, they threaten to pull millions of dollars if the administrations don't censor or silence the faculty. And there's a problem because they can't really legally do that. In many cases, I became the visible face of the movement on campus because they can't do anything to me, but they could do something to other people. I was both surprised and disappointed with the attitude of the administration, which remains the same. I mean, it's like a constant battle to prevent them from trying to limit our academic freedom or discourage us from, talking about these controversial things, which of course is exactly what we're supposed to be doing with the students.
Exactly.
But
And it's,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
no, it's broader than that. And I'm glad you're bringing it up and also the response, because it's one thing to have emotionally charged debates on campus. That's de rigueur. That's what we do. And on the, even on the nature of anti-Semitism, but it's another to use that charge to discredit and silence critics altogether, which is what we're seeing now. And you're saying that it didn't come necessarily from students, although there was students, but this
Yes.
from their parents and external forces. And it, and then you just raised what I think is the key question before we go on to what it was you were going to say in that talk. I want to go over that
Yeah,
too.
sure.
But just, you know, the question about academic freedom, the right to teach without fear from external influences that are seeking to shape what is said and what is taught. And you wrote in your blog piece on Verso Books blog that this is a new phase of persecution carried out with bipartisan support in higher education, is the battleground of this assault on the freedom of expression. And of course, I mentioned earlier banning of books and banning of discussion on all sorts of things. And it's almost as if I want to say ignorance about what academic freedom is, what freedom of expression is, but it's deeper than that. And, you know, I think you used the word weaponize. So I'd like you to just talk a little bit. And of course, what we should do as, you know, faculty and teachers and librarians and everybody else to fight back.
Yeah, I mean, it's in some ways there are some difficulties with responding to this, but what's happened, and I could see this with the small group of students that were very upset about this, is the immediate recourse to the discourse of you've made me uncomfortable. But when they say
That's
something
what we're
like
supposed to do.
you're making me afraid, I don't know what that means because nobody's being assaulted, attacked, or I mean, I'm a leftist, and very few of my students ever have agreed with me politically, and I haven't punished them or humiliated them or anything of the kind. And same thing now. I think this discourse of you're making me uncomfortable, you're making me feel like I don't belong, I feel like someone's going to attack me or something, physically attack them, which I don't think is ever going to happen. If you have political differences with students, they may not like you. They may say, I don't want to deal with you. I don't want to talk to you.
Or not take
And
a class from you. They can, you know.
well, I mean, but okay, if they feel that I, am terrible, I can't be fair to them or something. Okay, I can't do anything about that. But I mean, if you take the position that Israel shouldn't have to have a ceasefire or something, yes, people are going to be unhappy with you, and they may be disturbed by your politics and the implication. And I mean, the other thing that we didn't even talk about is the fact that the Muslim and Palestinian students have received no such support, no such indulgence from the administration or the campus newspaper, which neglected them altogether. And we, the leader of the SJP, the Social Students for Justice in Palestine, of which I'm the advisor, somebody who has 30 relatives in Gaza. And, do you think she's having some anxiety? I mean, it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Who needs support? Who has a real material reason to be desperately afraid? She does.
I'm hearing about other campuses where students are starting to use Title IX
Oh,
as a
that's, yeah.
threat against professors' academic freedom.
Yeah.
And so it just seems like the bar has gone up, and this is what you rightfully call out in your blog as so disturbing, because this is part of a broad assault on dissent.
Yeah, that's when I was going to have a meeting with the, okay, I'll just say, an administrator, and I quoted part of the letter, which says a lot. I was going to be a Title IX person from Human Resources. I'm not going to go into all the complications, but the implication was I had made students uncomfortable. I made them feel fearful in my lecture, although the students complaining did not attend my lecture. They relied on the, as far as I can see from the testimony, of one student who's a first year, first semester student, and who was going in and out of the room during lecture and wasn't exactly. And so part of the accusation was ridiculous, et cetera. It's not a serious thing. It's not based on even listening to what I said. It's based on, some idea that I'm opposed to Zionism, which I am. And I think that the school wanted to use that against me to silence me and make me an example to other people that, you can't do this. And for various reasons, the faculty rebelled against this, and they actually passed a resolution that basically said you can't do any of this. So, okay, but I think the attempt was enough. And the attempt was based on, okay, we're not going to carry out some investigation of you for disciplinary purposes only because the complaint, which again I find bizarre, was not made by a student or employee of the college. Okay, but what if it was? If it was, then I could, according to the logic of the statement, be charged with some disciplinary infraction or something, which I have no idea what that would even be. And what was I charged with in terms of my lecture? But the meat of it was Israel is carrying out genocide and Israel is carrying out ethnic cleansing. And how could that possibly be an infraction of anything or merit disciplinary intervention when it's being debated all over the world, including by the International Court of Justice? It's
Right.
absurd. And the idea that you can't discuss something that's being discussed in every media outlet and is a subject of court proceeding is just absurd. I mean, it's impossible to make sense of that in some way. And okay, it ended up that because of the faculty resolution and other things, it was dropped. The whole thing came to nothing. But the fact that it even happened, it's the effect is lasting. The effect is, and I think we've had people who just became inactive faculty because they fear for their jobs, they fear they won't get promoted, they fear that they'll be fired. It's had its effect. It has a silencing effect on people, and they have to think many times carefully about contesting anything to do with Israel. Even talking about Israel becomes something very difficult. One of the primary topics that I covered in my lecture was precisely the weaponization of anti-Semitism.
Well, let me just interrupt you for a second, because I want to go right into that in a deeper way with you. And I want to just preface it by, I asked you if you thought that this kind of intimidation or persecution was successful. And just your answer says partially yes. And it's very dispiriting. And you brought up a bunch of other terms too. So before we go into that, we should say, that Hamas's brutal attack on October 7th, was rightfully shocked the world, but it was also a gift to Netanyahu because his government was crumbling. And he had weekly demonstrations, of most of the population, 80% of the population against him. He's long as he's in power, he's not in jail because he's been indicted. So there's a lot of different things going on. And yet we see abroad that this effort to equate criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism, which is just, by the way, so non-Jewish. When I think about Jews love to debate and call each other everything, and this attempt to stifle any debate and to put it all under one label is just, it's quite astonishing. So I just want to finish that by saying, of course, Netanyahu's response was not just disproportionate, but he's literally destroyed, more than certainly killed far, far more than were ever killed. The level of destruction, of housing, and now the refusal of allowing aid, such that even Biden now is going to airdrop and create a, a temporary pier. So you said that in your lecture, you talked about genocide or genocidal intent, population transfer, ethnic cleansing. All of that is now what people are discussing. And I have to say that I'm too prone to getting into nuances of expression, like is it genocide or genocidal intent? Is it settler colonialism or something more particular than that? But that's the wrong way to approach it right now. I think we have to just get this stopped. So I wanted you to, sort of address that and how you were going to address that in the weaponization of anti-Semitism in your talk.
Yeah, it did. I mean, I talked about it. What I did is I looked at the progression that led to the ultimate point that any criticism of Israel became de facto and in many cases de jure, an anti-Semitic comment. Okay. And that's important for a number of reasons. It's not just a moral question, because now there are different definitions of anti-Semitism, different documents that try to lay out all the possible forms that anti-Semitism can take, et cetera. And one of them is the International Holocaust Remembrance Group, the IHRA statement, which is the most expansive definition, problematic. But even that says, if you're talking about Israel in a way that you could talk about any other country based on its conduct, that's not anti-Semitism. Okay, but the practice is far beyond that. The practice now is any statement you make against Israel, any criticism, and not just criticism, if you show images or like video footage of dead children, dead people, now the phrase is, it's blood libel. Okay. And many people don't know what that means, but it's the accusation that originated in the medieval period in Europe that Jews are using the blood of Christian children to prepare the Passover matzah. And obviously that was a false accusation, but they're trying to say that any evidence presented against the state of Israel that they have killed children, for example, which is now about 14,000 children that they've killed, to bring that up is blood libel. Anything that points to murder, anything that points to, for example, now the preventing of food, and we see children dying of starvation. You're not supposed to talk about that. And until very re still probably on the books, but until very recently in practice, Israelis couldn't talk about that. If you mentioned that, there was the case of a school teacher who was arrested and put into solitary confinement, and he's probably in his 60s for saying something, it's bad what's going on in Gaza. It's absurd. So
Can I just interject too? Because I usually talk to Yoav Pellet about what's going on in Israel, and he said he just really can't do it now because his sister was fired. You know that the level of repression in Israel is increased, so that it makes it dangerous for them to speak out. And that's actually where we have to see the opposition if anything's going to happen. I was very gratified to just see on the news before I spoke to you that is CNN were showing a group of settlers with their babies saying no food should go in. They shouldn't have more than the minimal calories until the hostages are released. But at the same time, there was a convoy organized by anti-war people in Israel. They weren't allowed to get anywhere close, but it just shows that there at last is something. But anyway, I didn't mean to stop your
No. I
but
think that's right, because I think the success in other earlier periods of organizing against one of Israel's wars of aggression, it consisted of the fact that people in Israel, there was an anti-war movement in Israel that was very strong. Peace Now was at the beginning, and there were other parts of the left, but I think it's been missing for a long time. You know, I think the weaponization of anti-Semitism really took a huge leap forward around the war of 2014, because that was the first time that Israel openly experimented with allowing the public in a major way to see the atrocities that it was committing, the bombing of schools, of hospitals, UN refugee centers, huge apartment buildings, saying, you know, there's some Hamas person in there somewhere, we think. These are all crimes in various ways, but Israel was willing, not only willing, but wanted to show the world the kind of destruction and mass killing they were capable of. And in order to do that, or to facilitate that, they had to simultaneously define any criticism. So even if you criticized Israel for what Israel itself showed you, the bombing and dead bodies all over the place, if you criticized them for that, you were guilty of anti-Semitism, blood libel, et cetera, et cetera. And they tried to tie every criticism to some trope or stereotype of anti-Semitic discourse over the centuries, which is absurd. I mean, if you kill somebody, you kill somebody. That's it. But at that point, there was a huge kind of consolidation of Jewish opinion in the major institutions in the U.S. and Israel to really push for defining anything that Israel does that violates international law. If you criticize that, it's anti-Semitic. So they wanted to rule out basically any criticism of Israel's conduct during its wars, and, you know, in many cases, Israel's conduct period, but especially during war. That was the beginning of this movement, and it was difficult to really convince people, even within the Jewish community in the U.S. and elsewhere, to accept this. But what I experienced was there is a hardcore, and it's extensive enough, and especially institutionally, that has absolutely accepted this. And the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, it's complicated because they initially embraced that, but then during the Trump administration, and especially after Charlottesville in 2017, when you had all these Nazis and Klan, et cetera, all gathering together, they panicked because they saw real anti-Semitism, not the fake anti-Semitism of criticism of Israel, but, you know, people who really hated Jews. And they panicked, and they started to move away from, you know, if you love Israel, you're with us. We don't care what you do. And then they became a little more discerning, because there were, in fact, many of the participants in the 2017 demonstration of the far right were totally supportive of Israel, and they still are. You have people like Marjorie Taylor Greene, too many to even go
Trump
through.
Trump himself.
Yes, who are, I mean, they're totally anti-Semitic, and whether they realize it or not is irrelevant. And yet the ADL is perfectly willing to accept their support as long as they support Israel. It's like Orban in Hungary. You know, he can hate, you know, Jews and have all kinds of, you know, measures against individuals, etc. But at the same time, you know, he, if he supports Israel, which he does, probably out of Islamophobia, etc., then he's great. You know, he's fine.
That's a really good point that you've brought up too, because you know what we're seeing is a sort of, you know, weaponization of Jewish theocracy in some ways. And
Yes.
you know, you mentioned that, you know, there used to be this large peace now movement. It's been obliterated.
Yeah.
Again, part of it is because I think, you know, the arrival of 2 million Soviet Jews in
Yes.
Russia. It's also the religionization of Israeli society that it was, you know, back in the day when Israel was first established, it was liberal, progressive, secular Jews who, you know, reacting to the Holocaust were very supportive of this early effort. But all of that is gone. And now you see, in a way, and I'd like your take on it is, you know, Netanyahu and, you know, they really are the tail wagging the dog around the world on this issue, you know, and it's so complicated in the United States and tied up with domestic politics where the Democratic Party has to kind of, you know, walk on eggshells, not wanting to alienate Jewish supporters who are supportive of Israel, and on the other hand, outraged by the level of destruction and literally the bad image, apart from the collective punishment. And so it's a really interesting sort of moment, and I think a very key one in terms of what can be done. So I didn't really ask you a question, but I was curious because you started out by saying that you, in your talk, went back to the history of Jewish anti-Zionist movements from the Bund to the communists to like peace movements. And
Yes.
that just seems like it seems for on the one hand, there needs to be a giant educational effort
Yeah.
because that's what's happened on the other side. They've erased this history.
Yes. I think that's critical because I don't know if I mentioned it there. I have some other things, but the history of Jews involved in the Communist Party in the US, of the Bund in Europe, which is much larger than the Zionist movement until the war. People don't even know these things exist, and they think, the entire history of the Jews from, I don't know, the destruction of the temple to now is one long trajectory towards the restoration of the Jewish homeland or something. It's completely wrong. It's not that. And the history of Jews on the left in the last couple of centuries is extremely important. And I always, when I would talk about this, I'd always ask Jewish students, how many of you have a communist or socialist grandparent, great-parent? And almost everybody does.
Yes.
And so what does that mean? The students who are very connected with Zionism, they don't think it's true. I mean, they think, that's not what we were taught. And we're taught everybody is just wanting to get to Israel. And one of the things that disturbed the students who at least heard a report of my talk was the fact that I said that people didn't want to go to Palestine. Many of the people who ended up going to Palestine didn't want to go there. They had no choice. And they
Right.
weren't allowed to come to the U.S. There were laws passed in the 1920s that limited the number of Jews who could come into the country, even though they had family who could have supported them, and they were made to go elsewhere, and they ended up, for other reasons that aren't just about Zionism, but imperialism, etc., they ended up being sent to Palestine. So, but the history is everybody just, or the Zionist history is everybody was dying to go to Palestine, which is absurd. And the issue that you raise of the necessity of opposition in Israel is actually very important because Israel is too useful and way too important for the US and the European powers for them to just forget about it and turn against it. It's not going to happen under these circumstances anyway. And I think that there has to be, and there used to be, not just with Peace Now, but there used to be an Israeli left that was, I mean, there is one in the
Broad-based, you mean.
Communist Party or something, but it's very small. Very barely represented, and it's subject to all kinds of abuse and harassment all the time. And until there's a kind of break in Israeli society, it's not going to get any better there. And I think it's not only that it's becoming more religious, it's the kind of Judaism that's emerging, which is this messianic which is a very dangerous kind of messianic. It's messianic in a way that sanctions, that allows any kind of violence at the time of the messianic era. And that Gershom Scholem, the famous historian of Jewish mysticism, interesting character who went to Israel as a young man and stayed, but was quite critical of the state of Israel, like Hannah Arendt and other people who may or may not have gone. And he, because he had devoted quite a bit of his academic work to messianism in Judaism, he was saying this is a really dangerous thing because in at some point there was a in the 17th century there was a self-declared messiah, Sabbatai Zvi, who
Right.
was in Izmir in Turkey, and his followers engaged in a kind of deliberate violation of law, of Jewish law, as a marker of the imminence of the messianic arrival, or it was there already. And what Scholem says is that this now expresses itself not as a violation of kashrut or something like that, but as a violation of the laws of war and violence. So, okay, Sabbatai Zvi, they would have orgies and things like that. But now it takes the form of orgies of violence and killing, which they're perfectly comfortable with. And their messianism feeds this idea that, they have the right, or they've been sanctified in such a way that they can carry out whatever violence they feel like doing. And they're revising the traditional commentaries on scripture and things by Maimonides, et cetera, to make it okay. So rabbis at the beginning of this whole thing, some rabbis came in and said, I give you permission, like, ridiculous. I give you permission to remove all restrictions to violence. Okay. So you can kill women, children, et cetera. And then you have Netanyahu using the example of Amalek from the Bible, from Samuel, the book of Samuel. And it's basically you not only have the right or the permission, you must kill every single man, woman, child, cattle and donkeys. So you have to exterminate them. And if you don't, and Saul, who was king at the time, didn't, he was punished for that by God. Okay. So they're under the same imperative. You must kill every last one of them. And of course, these are the kinds of speeches that don't, I mean, they now have gotten into English, but if you listen to the Hebrew talks that they give, the speeches, the instructions to soldiers, they're filled with genocidal language. And yeah, we can say, should we call it genocide? They haven't killed every last Palestinian. That's not really the approach to genocide we want to take. You have to wait till it's all done. But I mean, they're openly advocating genocide and ethnic cleansing, which you can see because the messianic cult is very closely connected with the settler movement, and they're all spokespeople, like Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, et cetera. They're spokespeople for the settler movement in the government at this point, and
And we've
they
seen,
are.
of course, even the plans released that they can't wait to go back to Gaza or go into Gaza
Yes,
to
exactly.
reduce the strip to almost nothing, to force them, into Egypt, to have a worse Nakba. It's so, as I'm listening to you, Warren Montag, I'm just, overwhelmed with how successful this long-term effort has been, on the part of Israel, to bring about this kind of world acceptance of this view, even though now we're seeing demonstrations against it. I'd like to, sort of start to move there, but finish your thought because I want to think about, how big the task really is now to
Well,
counter it.
what I would say is that to pick up what I was saying about the
Smotrich and
recognition of it.
Ben-Gvir and their statements.
Yes, I mean, okay, but they have basically said we have the right to do whatever we want, okay, because they see themselves as we're in the messianic era, blah, 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 okay. But I think when it comes to this weaponization of anti-Semitism, which is connected with that, because they feel that no one should be able to criticize Israel at all, and that whatever criticism is uttered, or even, if you look at something like Ben-Gvir talking to the families of the hostages, okay, he's not sympathetic. He's saying, maybe they should just have to die. I mean, that's the way it goes. And this is somebody who the idea of human life is not at the center of their worldview, and they're in some kind of ecstatic state, and it's a problem. But to go back to the weaponization of anti-Semitism, which is in many ways fed by this, the idea now is not just you're going to be called an anti-Semite if you criticize Israel. In many states now, and I don't remember the exact number, but in many states in the US and many countries in Europe, they've adopted this very broad definition of anti-Semitism. And so you get, like in London, people are outraged that they even had a demonstration in support of Palestine, that in and of itself, you're regarded as a Hamas supporter. Or pro-terrorist or something
Or
like
the
that.
statement, I don't know who said it in the cabinet, that all Palestinians are
Yes.
Hamas.
Well, Mike, you mean, but in Israel they said
Yeah,
that.
in Israel, not here.
Oh, I mean if you look at the president, Herzog, Netanyahu, and Gallant, the Minister of Defense, they've said genocidal things over and over and over, and they were cited in the International Court of Justice case. Because if you say everyone is responsible, we're going to reduce that place to a burning heap of rubble, well, then yeah, you're advocating genocide. They're in the you know, they're attempting to carry it out. It's a serious thing.
It's
But what we've
incredible
seen.
to me, if I could just say, that they're using the tactics that the Nazis used against them without any sense, of recognition, or maybe they just supported it. Who, of course, they didn't support the Nazis, but it is truly, it's not ironic. It's terrible that this is
No,
what's, come
it's
to
a
pass.
source of shame as far as I'm concerned, because
And you could also say that it's responsible for increasing the real kind of anti-Semitism in Israel.
yes, of course it is, because they're realizing or they're identifying with these anti-Semitic views of Jews. It's like they've adopted it with a vengeance, and they're going to say, we don't care about anybody else, and we're going to do what we want. If it means killing a bunch of people, so what? But what I was going to say about weaponization is that now it's a matter of law, and you can see from even what happened with me unsuccessfully is there's an attempt, a push to be able not simply to ruin somebody's reputation or whatever, but to damage their career, to get them fired, to get them demoted. Disciplinary action simply for criticizing Israel. And of course, this is great for people that want Israel to do whatever it feels like. But I mean, the idea which I've heard at school, that even saying ceasefire now is an anti-Semitic statement, which I've read in various newspapers. I was because I saw an analysis of some demonstration. I forget what the newspaper was, and it said it was, oh, there was all the, there were many, many anti-Semitic slogans, like what? Ceasefire now, free Palestine, some, not even the from the river to the sea, but some Intifada, is Elise Stefanik, she's the great Hebrew scholar. Or sorry, Arabic scholar, and they anything becomes an anti-Semitic statement, and but in these cases, it's coming to the point where you could be prosecuted for making those statements, And you know, who gets to define what's anti-Semitic, et cetera. But it also, the fact that you, at the same time, you have Jews, many Jews, who are out protesting, and they're all anti-Semites. And so the ADL in particular, they basically said, and I don't think it's gone over completely well, but they've said that the Jewish Voice for Peace is no different than some, you know, anti-Semitic organization of non-Jews. And it's you know, they don't get, the fact that it's made up of primarily of Jews is irrelevant. It's what you, it's no longer about Judaism, it's about Israel. And so you become a Jew, you're a Jew or not a Jew based on your attitude towards Israel, as far as they're concerned. And you're right. I mean, historically, this is absolutely heretical to have a statement like that, because it's even people who are atheists, et cetera, were, the tradition was you accept them as part of the community, period. And that's gone now. I mean, that is absolutely not the case. And this is a, I would say, for Judaism in some way, it's a crisis. It's an identity crisis. And they've supplanted, you know, this whole tradition with Israel. And then you get people like Ben Gvir, et cetera, who are, you know, nightmarish. And I talked about the dangers of this weaponization, and that it makes any kind of di obviously it makes discourse about Israel impossible, and the only thing you can do is let them do whatever they want. And as you say, in many cases, it will create anti-Semitism, and then you get, if you're a Jew, you get blamed for it, and you'll pay the price for their misdeeds. And I think it's an extremely difficult thing. But there's a strong push to adopt these very expansive definitions, but at the same time, there is resistance among Jews, especially. And there's a very, very interesting case of the newspaper The Forward. And there was an interesting article, I think it was in The Forward itself, or I'm not sure about that, but saying that when The Forward tried to, this is a couple of months ago, support some sort of initiative that was pro-war for Israel, they had two absolutely distinct and opposing responses from their readers. And one, the older readers were very much in favor of, you know, Israel no matter what, et cetera. But the younger readers, and especially, which I thought was very interesting, the Yiddish oriented, because they have a Yiddish supplement, the Yiddish oriented younger readers were almost uniformly opposed to supporting Israel. And the newspaper was very puzzled by this and troubled, and they didn't know what was going on. But I think that's exactly right. I think the younger people are interested in this other history of Jews, and not just Ashkenazi Jews, but Jews in other places. And they're interested in recovering that. But many of them also identify with, I mean, there's some revival of interest in the Bund, for example. And it's not a smug. I mean, I think a lot of people in both If Not Now When and Jewish Voice for Peace are very, very interested in the what those politics were. And I think it's a very interesting, it's a counter Zion, I mean, it's counter to Zionism. And it's a different history. It's a history of a left-wing approach, which, you know, and I would say what's interesting about both groups, they're much more interested in the religious side, probably the people in the Bund used to be, and they very much identify as Jews, but they're out there with Black Lives Matter and everything. You know, it does it they don't see Judaism as some kind of separate enterprise or something like that.
It's really interesting. We have to kind of wrap it up, but what you're raising, which others have done in the past too, is this sort of universalist tradition within Judaism as opposed to the kind of narrow nationalist chosen people. And the universalist tradition has given us Marx and Spinoza and Trotsky and Luxembourg and big thinkers around the world who fought against this. So the last thing that you said, Warren, about, you know, the rising interest again in this history from even religious Jews. That's the sign of hope, that I'm always looking for at the end of every broadcast. But I think, because I was going to ask you to go on and we've run out of time to talk about, what could be done here in this country to ramp up the pressure. Because, as I don't know how much U.S. military aid will be decisive for Israel. At some point, times it seems as though they can do without it and still wreak havoc and destruction. But, maybe you could just give me your final comments with, how you see what can happen next.
Yeah, I am somewhat hopeful because I think there's a unity between the Palestinian youth movement, which is very strong, very active, very powerful, I think, and Jewish Voice for Peace. And if not now, when? They work together. They have built very huge, very successful demonstrations, and they keep pushing. And I think that unity is a pull of attraction for people, especially younger people. And I think that we have to continue to build that. And I think that there's what I see in both movements there's a tremendous commitment to this other vision. And I don't think the future is going to lie with Israel, let's put it that way, and the crazy messianic thing that's going on. I think that the future is going to lie with this other movement, and it's not Jews against other people or something like that. It's a willingness to support everybody's struggle. And I'm very impressed by Students for Justice in Palestine also. I mean, these are very intelligent students, very committed, and I think the future, at least potentially, lies with them, and I support them.
Warren Montag, thank you so much for all of that. And I want to encourage those of you listening to go to Verso Books blog and look at his article piece on the new McCarthyism, a personal testimony that tells his story. Warren is a tenured professor, full professor at Occidental College, and the author of many works that we don't have time to go over with. But thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Susan.
Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Susie Wiseman. This is Jacobin Radio. Thanks to producer and director Alan Minsky and to Jacobin Radio's Micah Utrecht. Bhaskar Sunkara is the founder and editor of Jacobin Magazine, and special thanks to Robert Brenner, and thanks to you for listening. I'm Susie Wiseman.